Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Wednesday, the 17th of February. Very nice to have you with us on this day. It is it's pretty out. Hopefully you are enjoying the beauty. You know, that ice just glimmers. It's really pretty, unless you walk on it. But please don't do that. Be very, very careful. It's a jungle out there. But good morning. Welcome. And we have a great panel. Let us get started. We welcome you to the proceedings. A reminder, panel at WAMC.org, if you'd like to join us, panel at WAMC.org, and we are interested to hear what you have to say. WAMC's Alan Chartok is here. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Good morning, Joe. I'm doing okay, just okay. I was out, and your warning about the ice is so profound. There's some real bad ice in front of our house,
yeah,
and you got to be very, very careful.
Yeah, you do. You know, I went to Mass this morning. It's Ash Wednesday, so I went to Ash this morning, and I went in and so in this age of COVID, Bob, you're a fellow Catholic boy, right?
Yes.
Okay. So I went in and usually. You have the priest who's been sitting there with their fingers in the ashes for 3 minutes just grinding it down, and by the time they get to you, it just looks like you have an entire like a paint swatch on your face. So today I was interested to see that they, in the world of COVID, it's now do it yourself. They have the ashes in a little cup, and I thought, oh, this is great, because I will just gently put my thumb in and I will apply, and it will only be a little bit, and it won't be, as it looks like I've been spray painted. I don't know how else to describe it. I don't know what happened, but I just the top quadrant of my face is just bright black. But anyway.
You want to yell freedom when you're walking out of church, huh?
Anyway, you feel like you're taking extra holy water to try to douse it off. Anyway, good morning to you, Bob Griffin, Dean of College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Cybersecurity at the University at Albany. Hello. How are you?
Hello, Joe. And not only is it icy and ice is slippery, but gravity works, as I found out this morning myself. So,
oh, God, did you fall?
I took a little tumble, yes.
Oh, dear.
I find that I don't bounce quite as well as I did when I was younger, but no. still plugging along.
But you're okay.
Joe, before I move on, though, I just want to wish Sarah a belated happy birthday. I know it was on Friday.
Yep.
I didn't get an opportunity. I just want to wish her a happy birthday for everything that she does.
Yeah, if only they had, cards or something. Yeah. No, that's very nice of you. Thank you.
Thanks, Joe.
Oh, just teasing. Times Union columnist Chris Churchill is with us. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm good. I'll send Sarah a happy birthday, too.
Yeah,
happy
there
birthday,
you go.
Sarah.
Yeah. Well, I don't think Sarah has no problems celebrating her birthday for a week. I have no issues there at all. Rosemary Armeo is here, investigative journalist, UAlbany adjunct professor. Good morning, Rosemary. How are you?
Good morning. I'm fine. There's no ice in the house. And I sent greetings to Sarah kindly.
You're very nice. You're a
good
person.
With all that moonshine, you have no ice? Really? No.
Yeah, good point. Welcome, everyone. Let's get started. We have a lot to talk about, and we'll, you know what? Yesterday, I was compiling, I usually the night before, I put together a docket of possible stories that we may get to and things that we can talk about, just so we're all on the same page. And yesterday was the first day in 4 years that I felt, oh, this is sort of a normal day where I have choices, and it was very interesting. I think we've got some interesting things to talk about today. So as soon as I'm able to bring them up on my computer, which I currently am not because I don't have internet, but I'll be with you in just a second. Well, I wanted to start talking about the Texas power grid and what's happening there, and the questions that has brought up, and I'm interested in, Bob, I know this is part of your expertise as to how these things work, but, why is this such a problem? We don't expect it to get that cold in Texas, but here we go, and now the entire, almost, you know, that much of the state is having a really horrible problem.
Yeah, and there's a couple twists to the Texas story. The first twist is that the Texas electric grid, unlike all of the other states, I think with the exception of Hawaii and Alaska, are interconnected. So that means that New York's grid is connected to Pennsylvania and Massachusetts and Vermont. So there's this idea that there's the redundancies built into the system. Texas is not built that way. It is a standalone system. What you're seeing is a couple of things. One is the overall vulnerability of our critical infrastructure. And this is something that I've been hoping from the prior administration. I'm hoping now from the Biden administration that the federal government actually puts some serious money into our critical infrastructure. And part of that is absolutely the electric grid. The other piece of this, and I think this is maybe part of the more interesting conversation to have today, is that, you know, this is the market at work. You know, Texas prides itself on sort of this, you know, they beat their chest about how independent, and they brag about how strong they are. And of course, until they have a problem, and then the rest of us have to bail them out. And if you're sitting at home saying, oh, no, that's not the case, I just point you to Ted Cruz's tweet last year about California, right, where, you know, when California was going through those horrible fires and the issues with their electric grid, he said, quote, California is now unable to perform the basic functions of civilization. Well, there's two lessons here. One is that you shouldn't tweet about somebody else's misfortune because you're calling it on yourself. And the second is that this is a reflection of deregulation, Joe, that there wasn't enough regulation, I believe, in place in order to assure that the electric providers were putting money back into the critical infrastructure. It was more about taking profits out than it was making sure that the system was good.
It is interesting. I mean, obviously, you look at the political ramifications coming from Texas, and the Texas political scene is much different, as you point out, than the California political scene, obviously. But huge winter storms plunge large parts of the central and southern United States into an energy crisis this week, with frigid blasts of Arctic weather crippling electric grids and leaving millions of Americans without power amid dangerously cold temperatures. The grid failures were most severe in Texas, where more than 4 million people woke up on Tuesday morning to rolling blackouts. Separate regional grids in the Southwest and Midwest also face serious strain. As of Tuesday afternoon, at least 23 people nationwide had died in the storm and its aftermath. Analysts have begun to identify key factors behind the grid failures in Texas. Record-breaking cold weather spurred residents to crank up their electric heaters and push power demand beyond the worst-case scenarios that grid operators had planned for. Chris Churchill.
Well, I know we want to blame politics for everything, but the fact that we see these kind of blockouts in almost all parts of the country suggests to me that it's not just about politics, right? I mean, sometimes there are just weather events that cause unexpected outcomes. And we've had ice storms here in the Albany area that have knocked out power for people for days and days. And it doesn't surprise me at all that an ice event in Texas would do the same thing. That said, it does get fairly cold in Texas, not, you know, at least once or twice a winter. I've lived in Texas. It depends on what part of the state you're in. But it does get fairly cold at times, and it does seem like the state should be a little bit better prepared for cold weather when it does come.
And it's, you know, it's like when a southern state gets snow. I mean, they don't have plows because they're just not expecting it. So, but this does seem to be different. Alan, your thoughts on this?
Well, I think Chris is right on the money. It's preparation. You know, politics has destroyed a lot of people who were not who have not been where they should be and what they're doing, what they can, or who are perfectly blameless but still get the blame. We have seen that happen, and so now we have mayor in Texas who resigns, suggesting that you know, the people were stupid for not having taken care of each other and that they're whiners. You know, I mean, look, the mark of a politician is being able to respond to crisis and respond well. I think that's what what is why Cuomo got his high creds and why, to some degree, he's in a little bit of trouble right now, but not that much. I truly believe it's all about being able to react to circumstances. They throw a ball at your head, and you either know how to deflect it or not.
Rosemary.
Okay, so I want to blame politicians and big corporations because they're all complicit in this. First, Texas, the biggest supplier of natural gas in the country, runs out of natural gas. This, if nothing else, is bad planning. It's that right there. They did, as Bob said, plan not for weather this bad. They gambled that it would never get this bad, and so there's no other mechanism set up to protect. It's all set up to sell off all the natural gas and to keep prices as low as possible and profits as high. And it is not unique to Texas, although it's particularly egregious there. We also saw it in California with the utility that had such bad infrastructure that it contributed to forest fires, to wildfires last year. So they're totally complicit. The second thing are the freaking lying politicians who are now saying it was frozen wind turbines that caused it.
Yeah.
Wind provides 10% of the power in Texas. It is not the major cause at all. And they're also saying, oh, we need deregulation. No, we don't. Deregulation is, this is what it gets you, is that you're not prepared for emergencies. If you're not prepared for sharing, if this were happening and it was part of the grid like the other states, it would have been regulated. And in an emergency like this, Texans would have gotten energy supplies from surrounding states and would be just fine right now. So this is they should be blaming two people first. Wait, one more thing. I'm hearing politicians led by the Texans, the idiots, talking about how this proves what a bad deal the Green New Deal would be because it would invest in alternative power. And so that's what's failing right now. So they're lying, and their greed has caused this problem, and there's plenty of blame. This is not just a snowstorm in New York. Siberia doesn't run out of electricity. Norway doesn't run out of electricity. Why is Texas? We're turning into a third world country.
Well,
it's hard to gaslight everybody when you have no gas, isn't it?
Dan Crenshaw, the representative from Texas, has been tweeting wildly on this and making many of the points that Rosemary has said that are on the other side. This is what happens when you force the grid to rely in part on wind as a power source. When weather conditions get bad, as they did this week, intermittent renewable energy like wind isn't there when you need it. I think in a span of about 20 minutes, he texted or he tweeted about 40 times on this issue. I'm joining my Texas colleagues and getting to the bottom of what happened. We can do better. This is a once-in-a-century event. I don't know that we know that. It's a once-in-a-century weather event. California has constant energy problems and high prices. The reason for blackouts is complex, but in summary, Texas took too many lessons from Cali over subsidized renewables and pushed out baseload energy like natural gas. The conservative guide to the culture wars, in no particular order, America is worthy of our love and patriotism. Victor mentality is better than a victim mentality. Free speech is absolute. Hate speech is not an objective term. Okay.
Well, the one thing he said there that's definitely true is that the power outages are a complex issue. And I do think there's a danger of oversimplifying and just blaming one thing or another. It is true that some of the wind turbines froze. It's also true that a lot of the natural gas generators froze. They just don't build, and maybe they should, but they just haven't built things in Texas to be prepared for ice storms like that or for that kind of cold weather. And things will go wrong sometimes. I mean, obviously Texas needs to improve its system. But, you know, in some ways, Texas deserves credit. 10% of your power coming from wind is pretty high for this country. I mean, Texas is way ahead of the game in a lot of these areas.
Yeah.
They're much more reliant on natural gas than a lot of the rest of the country, where coal is still an important factor. And coal is actually easier in these sorts of situations because it's easier to store. I mean, this is a really complex issue. And to just, you know, point out a few tweets from a few dumb politicians and just, you know, make it a red versus blue issue.
I can counter that. Yes, it is. I can counter this, Chris. Yes, it is indeed a very complex issue. That's my cuckoo.
Perfect timing. Did you pay for that, Chris? That could have been better.
Yeah, I think the clock agrees with me.
Go ahead.
And you're both cuckoo. You're talking about the people who they're living. Their job is to look at these complex issues and to plan out systems. Mm-hmm. And part of the problem is all along they are denying climate. They're denying climate change in Texas. So, of course, they're unprepared and cooperate. Is it a surprise that it's getting colder in Texas? Well, it isn't to most of us who believe in climate change, but it appears to be to utility planners, both first now in California and now in Texas. And we have a wake-up call, and we're not seeing any evidence that they're moving. If they came out and said, oh, we had a really bad event, but here's how we know it isn't going to happen ever again because here's what we've done, I would say, yeah, you might have a point. But you don't, because they haven't. They're just saying, oh, this hardly ever happens. It's an act of nature. We can't do anything about it. That's their very job, is to do something about it.
Yeah, and Chris,
summer and New York City loses this power, we're going to hear the same things from our politicians. I mean, that's kind of what politicians do. But that doesn't mean that the solution isn't complex, or the reason that this happened isn't complex. I think, you know, like I said, Texas is ahead of the game in a lot of ways in the way that it generates power, in terms of the power being cleaner than a lot of the northern states. To just say that this is just because of dumb Texas politicians, I think. Maybe this is just getting my ire up a little bit because I lived in Texas for so long.
Yeah.
But I think that's just a simplification. I mean, the people who are in – you say that they're all climate deniers. First of all, not everybody lives in Texas is a climate denier. And I don't know that the people who plan this system are climate deniers. Just because a few dumb politicians are doesn't mean that the whole state gets a big red – letter on its chest.
I'll give everyone the right to reply. I do want to take a break, though. We'll do that. And when we come back, we'll continue this conversation, a spirited one, which is nice. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Chris Churchill, Bob Griffin, and Rosemary Armeo join us. Bob, you were going to reply, I believe, right before we went to break.
Yeah, there's a couple of points. One, you know, I agree with Chris in one respect, that these systems are very, very complex. But part of what we try to do in this college is to teach the students and the future leaders of emergency preparedness that you got to start to break down complex systems to understand how they're all interconnected. So the argument that it's a complex system, so therefore it's okay, is not one that I really hold to. The other issue I have, and I'd be interested in your perception, Chris, only 10% of the of wind power only 10% of Texas energy comes from wind power, but they are identifying this, and I've seen it in a couple of different places, as the reason that the power went out. And it strikes me as just really disingenuous on behalf of the politicians. You know, it wasn't only a wind issue, and I think you're absolutely correct, Rosemary, when you point to Greenland and Norway, which keep their turbines going in almost Arctic conditions, there's a lot that needs to be answered here. And a lot of it, I think, is going to come back to the fact that Texas has traditionally underfunded their critical infrastructure.
Chris, Rosemary?
Well, I mean, you probably are right that people are wrongly blaming wind energy, but I don't know. It depends on who you listen to. The governor said wind energy was part of the problem, but he also said that you know, the New York Times and other places have reported the wind turbines did freeze, that they're not built for this in Texas. They're not built for this sort of condition. And yeah, while it's true that wind turbines in, you know, Sweden or someplace could probably handle that kind of cold, we don't know that those wind turbines could handle, you know, the 110, 115 degree heat that Texas gets. So, I mean, you do build infrastructure for the climate that you're building it in. And I think, you know, as while it's true that we need to be prepared for unusual events, I also think it's a little bit disingenuous to try to tell the public that extreme events aren't going to cause some sort of discomfort. I mean, but that sometimes things just happen, and you do your best to prepare for it next time. But you know, the kind of finger pointing and political gamesmanship that happens almost every time now that we have some sort of hiccup or disaster, I think is it needs to stop. Really, it's not really helpful. It's just,
you know,
everything becomes this blue versus red.
Alan,
bickering.
You know, I don't agree with you, Chris. The truth of the matter is this political system works in two ways. Number one, when you go along and not much happens, politicians demand attention and they demand adulation. However, when things go wrong, it is appropriate, absolutely appropriate to say, where were you guys? Were you sitting on your behinds when you should have been thinking that this is going to happen? Because it is going to happen and it will happen. So I do think it's perfectly respectable to hold the people responsible who are in power because they didn't do their jobs well.
Rosemary?
Well, obviously I agree with that, but you also have to make some allowance. I mean, ice storms cause power outages. We've seen that here again and again and again. You know, this isn't a Texas problem. This is something that also weather does cause problems sometimes.
Rosemary.
Yeah, but that's the whole point. I think Chris has a future after this newspaper thing doesn't work anymore for him in corporate relations. Oh, it's just an act of God. We couldn't help it. I'm sorry. That is precisely what utilities are supposed to be doing. When do people most want power and electricity? During when it's cold, when there are ice storms, when it's raining. That's to fail then and just say, oops, we couldn't help it. That's just not acceptable. And it, this is a wake-up call. And it really doesn't matter what we say because we're up in New York. Plenty of Texans are going to be complaining their butts off, their cold butts off after this weekend. And I think that's good because I think the whole country does need a wake-up call about infrastructure, as Bob said earlier. This is a Texas problem right now, but it could be Oklahoma or New York or Pennsylvania tomorrow, where we do have to have systems where the wind turbines don't freeze and where the gas supply continues and that we can share from one place to another in emergencies like this. This is just strategic planning. Now, what it takes, of course, is political will and money. So we are right to be talking about the motivations of the politicians, because I don't see them rallying behind saying, wow, those fires and now this ice storm, we got to get going on this. Or even the storms in New York City that took out the areas along the coast, those were a wake-up call, and we've done very little to respond to that. And that is the fault of politicians and of company planners, of utility planners. And we should be able to rely on them. That's what they're there for. Yes, there's always going to be a real one-in-a-century emergency, but I don't think this is it. These sorts of extreme weather conditions have become extremely common over the last 5 years.
Yeah, a comment I just want to note for everybody that I really miss being in the studio, because the break would be tremendous watching the interplay between Rosemary and Chris. So I really do miss that. You know, one thing that we haven't noted, though.
Yeah, me too.
You know, one thing we haven't noted
well,
is...
Well, we go after you, Bob.
I am like the Switzerland of this panel, Rosemary. one thing that I do want to note, you know what we haven't been talking about in this conversation is the federal government doing or making stupid comments like, you know, you need to go rake the forest or we're going to withhold aid. I actually really appreciated the very simple fact that the current administration just said to, you know, what do you need? What can we do to help you? Rather than, like Chris was saying, continue to politicize. So to me, that's in a bad situation. At least there's a little bit of silver lining.
Nice job, Switzerland. All right, let's go to some letters here. Tom says Texas is experiencing its cold weather because the polar vortex has spread farther south than normal this winter. This is an effect of higher than normal temperatures in upper atmosphere in the Arctic. I heard this on WAMC, so I know it's true. Thus, Texas is now experiencing an effect of global warming. Global warming requires the same level of immediate focus, widespread attention as the COVID pandemic. I love the ongoing cuckoo clock joke. Tough times call for good humor. Okay.
Unless, of course, you have no sense of humor, then you'll write us a letter saying that.
This is not a laughing matter. Please do not make fun.
Either that or you're Mitch McConnell, one of the two.
Dour and sour.
Yeah, well, get to him in a minute. Stacy writes to us and says, Chris, if New York State can have 28% of its electricity come from renewable energy sources, Texas and the quote-unquote warmer states should be doing better. 10% of Texas is wind, and their overall renewable is only at 15%. That's a bogus argument. The governor of Texas is a moron, says Stacy.
You know,
well, I think New York is at 4% with wind. So, I mean, Texas is doing a lot better than New York in that one area. You know, a lot, as much as people like to point at states like Texas, so sometimes those states have done pretty well with switching to renewables. I don't know the total renewable package, but you know, I have to say it is kind of funny. It does amuse me that of all the controversial things we've discussed on this show over the years, that Rosemary and I can get worked up about the energy grid in Texas. It's kind of refreshing, actually.
It's what I said when I started off. Like, I love that this is the story we're talking about.
Of course, Rosemary, I just want to make sure that you appreciate the fact that New York is going to do better. And it's already talking, and here we go, Rosemary, putting some of these generators out in the ocean next to Fire Island.
There you go.
God, you can do that. And on any topic, I swear.
We have
Fire Island angle. That is interesting, though, Chris, about the renewable energy, the wind energy specifically in the Northeast, where, of course, energy is important. In Pennsylvania and in New York is 4%, but Pennsylvania and the states around, I haven't looked up Massachusetts yet, are much lower, like under 2%. So I also can fault the utilities here in the Northeast as well. There you go.
Yeah, and the other piece about Texas.
Just to be clear, I'm not trying to excuse the outages. I'm not saying that this isn't a problem we need to look at and address. All I was trying to say is that the kind of the political finger pointing that happens every time, it just gets tiresome to me. You know, it seems like instead of actually addressing problems, it just becomes, oh, look at the dumb Republicans or look at the dumb Democrats. I mean, that's what Ted Cruz did essentially, with you know the wildfires in California. And now it's coming back to bite them, and it just. To me, it just seems like every time something happens, that's what we resort to, and it's just unhelpful.
So why isn't it responsible of us to hold the people who are doing this to account? That Chris,
we
is
should.
My
problem. But we should also know what we're talking about, and I don't think any of us are experts in the Texas power grid, right? I mean, it's a complex problem, and to just say, yeah, we should hold people accountable. If we lived in Texas, they should absolutely be holding the people who were responsible for this accountable. But I don't see anybody really trying to do that. I just see kind of empty finger pointing and empty blaming.
But you know, Chris, it's not the way it works. The way it works is most of us know very little about a lot of things, and we hold our politicians responsible for doing that knowing and for holding their bureaucracy responsible. So it seems to me it's entirely appropriate to finger point at when something like this happens. That puts us on different
sides.
You also need to get an honest accounting of why it happened.
Hold on. Go ahead. Chris?
Well, I was going to say, especially... Chris first. Okay. Sorry.
That's all right.
No, go ahead, Rosemary. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I think that you're right, that we don't know a lot about everything, and that gives the people who do know a lot, the experts, they have earned their reputation as horrible elites for exactly doing this, saying, well, we know more than you, we know better. And then you have an incident like this that shows, no, they don't know better at all. And we citizens do have to know more about the power structures that affect our lives, and that includes the infrastructure. And I recommend Rachel Maddow's book on blowback. She's not an expert on the fossil fuel industry either, but this is part and parcel of it. And politics and energy, fossil fuel and energy production are intimately wrapped up together in this country. You do have to put the two together. They're not separate at all. Politics have protected these companies, made them extremely wealthy, and it has come at the cost of the health and now the comfort of the American people.
We do.
Yeah, and, I mean, this is a question. This is something Bob could probably answer better than I could. But I mean, I would assume whenever you're making planning preparations and emergency preparations, you can't plan for every eventuality, right? You must. I mean, there's always a risk versus cost analysis that goes into these things, where somebody's going to say, well, that's extremely unlikely to happen, so we're not going to plan for that. And then, of course, that thing happens. I mean, isn't it fair to say you can't plan for everything, that you always have to gamble at least a little bit?
You know, you're absolutely correct. I mean, part of what I'd like to hear, though, is when they looked at the return on investment of hardening their electric grid, you know, what choice did they make? I mean, and I think that's where I'm getting to is like, okay, so if you made a choice because you only have a certain amount of money, you say, well, it's unlikely that we're going to get cold weather. I can live with that. I really can. It's understanding, though, what parameters did they put into their thinking. And you said it yourself that, you know, cold weather is not, you know, it happens in Texas. I mean, I was looking at one of the articles where I think there were 7 years in the past 20 that have had substantial cold. So it is one of those points that I do sort of cock my eye and say, okay, you should have prioritized this higher. And if you didn't, you really do need to moving forward. Now, one comment that you made that's absolutely correct, Chris. If Texas didn't prepare their grid to deal with hot weather, then all of us should be like, what in God's green earth are you doing? But it's always a trade-off. The other point that I will pitch right now to everybody listening is, yeah, it can happen here. And this is why you need to be prepared. This is why you need to have a go kit. This is why you need to understand in your own environment what you need to do in order to make sure that you can keep yourself and your family and your environment as safe as you possibly can. So have a plan, have a kit. I know we say it every year about, you know, having bottled water and some canned food and things like that, but it's really important.
I love that term, go kit. Okay. We're going to take a break.
Mike Spain has – oh, sorry. No. I was going to say Mike Spain has – I'll wait till later, Joe. Sorry.
Okay, no problem. We have to take a break. So when we come back, we'll continue. We have many letters on this that I want to get to. And we welcome yours, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Let's get to the letters. We have many, so we'll get started. And
can I just jump? Of course. Can I just jump in, Joe? Because I got a letter from our Mike Spain, who sent me a terrific article on why Texas has its own system, why it has its own electric grid, and it dates back to 1970, and it's exclusively because they wanted to avoid federal regulation, and that has been the rule. And this is what it gets you: the federal regulation is good, and that's a political issue. And another reason I think you're seeing the Texas politicians dance around what really happened.
Let's see. Let's go to letters. We go to Marge, who says this situation points directly to a stronger, well-run FEMA. We also got this one that is from Cheryl. I've complained in the past about Rosemary's use of the words third world country. What do you mean, Rosemary? Is there not a better, less racist term you can use?
The other word used now is underdeveloped, which means exact same thing. I'm not a believer in euphemisms. We're talking about the same thing. We're talking about impoverished countries that are not the advanced industrial countries like the United States and Western Europe.
We also...
Joe, before you go on, yes. One quick comment. You know, I appreciate the letter about FEMA. In reality, though, what it shows is, I think, more an inherent weakness at the state and local level. You know, the state and local governments should never depend on FEMA as the primary. They need to create systems themselves. They need to be the ones asking the questions of their critical infrastructure providers. They're the ones that should be updating their plans on a regular basis. They're the ones that really understand their communities, and it's their role. I mean, so really, when I look at this, it tells me a couple things. One is that Texas needs to put more money into their preparedness. And they need to do a really thorough job of looking and updating their plans.
Anybody else? Okay.
Yes, you're doing a terrific job, Brownie.
We go to, what is this person's name? Doesn't matter. We go to Elizabeth, who says, "Yay, Chris, thank you for your perspective. As you say, the underinformed finger pointing becomes tiresome and, in my opinion, boring, and it is not synonymous with holding people accountable. I would love to hear more ideas and discussions about practical and actionable solutions." While Chris is perhaps feeling good about that, I will say that Nancy writes, "It doesn't happen often, but I agree with Chris this time."
I knew it wouldn't last so long.
Doesn't happen often, but I agree with Chris this time. There's a huge problem with our infrastructure, not a red state or blue state issue. Then on to Kathy. "We need so much more federal funding to combat global warming." And to the letter writer stating, "There are 100-year storms, Hurricane Irene, which hit New York hard. I personally was landlocked for 5 days. Then Hurricane Sandy, which slammed New York City just the following year. These are no longer 100-year storms, but 10-year storms. And it's only going to get worse, I fear. Open up your eyes, folks," says Kathy.
Yeah, and just to correct one misconception, just because somebody says that the percentage of it, the opportunity for a 100-year storm is a certain percentage, that doesn't mean that it's going to be another 100 years before it occurs. It just means that every year there is an opportunity for these events to happen. In the larger events, it's rarer just because they are rarer, although the letter writer is noting that they're becoming more and more common, which means we need to start to really shift how we think. And I do support renewable and a multitude of different approaches to energy, but also the preparedness piece.
We go to Andy, who writes to us and says, "I've spent most of my working life in the electrical distribution business. The reason these power problems occur is because it is the cheapest way to do it. Watch the HBO miniseries Chernobyl. It lays all the issues out, although nuclear, it translates to any power producing system." Let's see. We go to...
There's an irony that occurs to me, in that Texas is usually criticized, and rightly criticized, for sucking down power like it's, you know, a Slurpee or something, just for its insatiable energy consumption. Texas generates a lot of power and uses too much power. They need to conserve more. And it's a little ironic now that they're being criticized, and I fear the consequences of criticizing them for not generating enough. It's a little bit of a strange... As someone who lived there in the summer, I mean, they air condition like you wouldn't believe. I mean, the air condition stores air condition and then leave the doors wide open.
Right. They air condition the outside. Kind of, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Does anybody think that the fact that Texas has a sort of Republican philosophy, which is, you know, leave it alone. You know, we want independence. We want people. And they elect political officials who are Republicans, and that some of this may be coming home to roost?
I mean, there might be some truth to that, but I think that political characterization of Texas is a little bit maybe outdated. I mean, most of the states most of the cities are as blue as you have a strange situation where most people live under blue local governments and a red state government. And in some ways, that creates a nice balance. You actually get kind of a competition of ideas.
I don't know why you think it's
but
nice.
Of course, when you're talking about electrical grid, you're talking more about the state than you are the local authorities. Go ahead.
I can live with that. Yes. The fact is, you know, that the state does tend to elect Republicans into the United States Senate as governor, and that hasn't changed. The fact that you have blue communities doesn't mean that they can, you know, run the politics of the state. They don't.
Right.
All right, let's go back to the letters here in our few minutes before the top of the hour. "It's important to point this out," says Luke. "Conservatives make assertions immediately, no matter how full of BS, to deflect blame and place it elsewhere. Hence, they blame wind turbines and the Green New Deal, which, by the way, doesn't even exist. Democrats don't play this game well, but the real reason Texas happened is the conservative dream of a deregulated market. They got their wish, and they're reaping the whirlwind. P.S. Texas wind is attributable to one person, T. Boone Pickens, the old man who used his clout to push his wind company. That from Luke.
Can I just say that politics and the fossil fuel industry in Texas are not very much distinguishable. So a whole lot of what you're seeing there isn't like Texans don't like a bunch of government. It's that fossil fuel giants who fund politics in Texas don't like it. And this is a result of it. And I almost could stand it if they were doing a good job. But this indicates to me that they're not even now supplying energy in an emergency situation. So that's part of my ire over this. And to blame the Green New Deal just seems so false.
Except
you can't blame just it's just not the Republican politicians who are constantly covering things. I mean, it's the state of our politics in general. I mean, we see it locally too. So I don't necessarily think that this is just a Republican issue. And Rosemary, you know, think back. You know, the rise to the power of both Bush 1 and 2 was fueled by Texas by Texas oil money. And the whole economy down there, and Chris, jump in on this one, is based on the cycles of booms and busts, according to what's happening with the oil industry. So it is really linked with Texas.
Yeah, that's my point. And mm-hmm. The politics of Texas are geared to whatever helps fossil fuel, and it has been for years.
And it was so good a point that I wanted to repeat it just to make sure we didn't miss it. So.
And on that note, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue and we'll point out points and we'll miss points and we'll do all of that. And we welcome your letters as well. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable. And our panel discussion, let me introduce everybody again to you. Alan Chartok, Chris Churchill, Bob Griffin, and Rosemary Armeo. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. I do want to move on to other subjects. I did get, during the break, got a letter from our own Linda Ellerby, who is a native Texan, of course. And she writes and says, I'm getting a good laugh from listening to you Yankees try to explain Texas. Perhaps it will help you to understand politics and how it works in my home state if I remind you that on one hot and unair-conditioned summer night in the early 70s, the Texas legislature voted to round off pi to 3. Have a good time, y'all. Love, Linda. Okay.
I have a serious
Linda.
Question.
I just thanks, Linda. Thank
That's
you for
great.
Listening too.
Put
That's
it into
great.
Chat. Yes, Alan, you're serious.
I have a serious question. Has anybody heard or anything from Mike Pence? Remember him? The former vice president of the United States who was threatened by the mob, whose family was threatened by the mob, and who still hasn't said one word, I would use an adjective, but it would be inappropriate. One word about what happened to him. Not a word. The guy's invisible.
I did. I saw his face on a milk carton. So, yeah.
I think he's smart to be doing this.
What? Just keeping shut?
I think he's really smart to be doing this. Yeah.
Why is that?
Because he's in a cooling off period. He wants those who hate him. His former supporters who hate him for not going along with Trump's plan to forget about that. He does not want to be part. Why would he come and be part of the narrative now? That wouldn't help him at all. He's planning his comeback, and it'll be some dramatic. He's counting, I think, on Americans' very short memory, and he will be back. We have not heard the last of him.
That may be, but his family? His family was with him, Rosemary, as he walked out. Is there, or as Mr. Welch once said, have you no decency? I mean, they went after him. They put a noose outside. I don't get that. You know, Rosemary,
look,
you may be right politically.
Ted Cruz there is no bigger toad except perhaps Lindsey Graham. And his family was vilified by Trump, and that didn't make a difference. And Jamie Raskin's family was there, too. He has decency. You see the difference. But this is about his political future. And Karen Pence is as much a part of the planning for that as Mike himself.
So you use the sentence, and I I didn't hear. Did you use the word turd? I wasn't sure what.
No, I did not use that word on the air. No, I did not. Although it is appropriate.
It's fair enough.
What did you hear, Alan?
Well, Alan, if his family's under threat, doesn't that kind of make sense that he might be kind of laying low for a while? I mean, those two things seem to go together. And
well, every politician in America at this point of the game, and you and I both have received some very threatening letters, Chris. We don't stop what we're doing.
Well, I don't know that too many politicians.
And he has
have been
Secret Service.
He
has Secret Service,
yeah,
and
I know,
don't.
I know.
I'm still.
But I can understand why he might not want to inflame the situation at this point. And you know, maybe he's writing. He's hard at work on his you know, tell-all book, which will tell us everything we need
well
to know about what it was really like in the Trump administration.
Well, yes, but on the other hand, look at who his boss was and his inflammatory language. And here is Pence, maybe delusional Pence, thinking that if he plays his cards right, as Rosemary intimates, he may be president of the United States. That guy is going to be nothing.
It could, or it could just be that he's a decent person and is trying not to continue the mudslinging.
Wait. It could be.
Chris, jump in, will you? You need to say something.
while we're talking about families, oh my. What a disappointment you are to us and to God. We were once so proud of your accomplishments. Instead, you go against our Christian principles and work for the devil's army. That is a letter from the family of Republican Representative Adam Kissinger. Or Kinzinger is how that is pronounced, I believe. They sent him a vitriolic letter accusing him of being a member of the devil's army in light of his criticism of then-President Donald Trump after the insurrection. It is now most embarrassing to us that we are related to you, they continued in the letter. You have embarrassed this family name. He was one of 10 Republicans who joined House Democrats voting to impeach Trump last month.
Well, that's the end of Thanksgiving.
Yeah. But, I mean, that's where to get you. Yeah, family. Yeah.
Can't live with them, can't get born without them. That's Alan Gerganis. You know, I'm also reminded of the family of Paul Gosar, the congressman from Arizona who has supported Trump's crazy election overthrow scheme. And his family, before he...
Uh-oh. I think we just lost Rosemary. We've been having that problem a bit. I don't know how to not have that problem.
Yeah, you always have that telltale brump.
Boop. Yeah, a little bloop.
Conspiracy.
What did you say, conspiracy?
It's a conspiracy. We're trying to
don't worry, Joe. It's not your fault.
Well, I don't know.
You're doing your best.
Yeah, it's we'll get her back. Okay,
we will.
So we go to another story here, and Alan had mentioned this earlier, but the president has. I'm also having internet issues, and I apologize for being slower on the draw than usual. But here we go. Former President Trump attacked Mitch McConnell as a political hack and says that he will back pro-Trump candidates. Former President Donald Trump lashed out at Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell on Tuesday for a lack of political insight, wisdom, skill, and personality.
All true.
The lengthy and personal diatribe issued through an affiliated super PAC confirmed that. Remember the good old days when that just would have been a series of tweets? The lengthy and personal diatribe issued through an affiliated super PAC confirmed that Trump plans to be an active combatant in the battle for the direction of the Republican Party that threatens to play out in the months and years to come. It escalated that growing rift in the party about whether it will be controlled by pro-Trump forces unwilling to question the actions and record of the former president or those viewed as more traditional Republicans focused on building the party around a political philosophy that will resonate with more voters. Trump's statement came after McConnell voted to acquit Trump but harshly criticized him for being practically and morally responsible for provoking the Capitol attack and indicated that the party needed to turn away from Trumpism to win back its majority in the Senate. McConnell also suggested that there could be legal consequences for Trump's conduct at the end of the riot. Mitch is a dour, sullen, and unsmiling political hack, and if Republican senators are going to stay with him, they will not win again, Trump said in a statement. He will never do what needs to be done or what is right for our country. How significant is this, Alan Chartok?
Well, you know, it's very significant in that what would be much better for our country, sarcasm alert, is incipient fascism that this ex-president now brings to us and lying and all the rest of it. Look, I'm no Mitch McConnell fan, that's for sure. And, you know, I love watching this. This is like watching the Iran-Iraq war back in the old days. You don't know which side to be for. But the fact of the matter is that McConnell was forced, I say, to do what was right and to call out Trump. And he did it, although he darn well should have voted, if he felt that way, to convict, and brought several Republican senators along with him. But he took a look at the cards. He said, I don't have it, so I'm not going to do it.
Bob Griffin.
Yeah, it's interesting. And one thing I'd like to point out is that Mitch McConnell is 78 years old, and he just won another six-year term.
Is that
so
old?
You're talking about going up for re-election at 84. So I don't think that he's quite as worried about that as maybe some others.
So why did he vote wrong?
You know, I don't know. And I thought it was absolutely disingenuous to not support the impeachment and then stand up and talk about how vile and potentially criminal the actions were. You know, as I was reading this article, one of the things I was thinking, you know, for Mitch, this is what happens when you spent the last 4 years petting a rabid dog and having it attack others, is that eventually it attacks you. And that is exactly what is going on here.
Absolutely.
Right,
absolutely.
Chris.
No, it's amusing to me that most of the adjectives that Trump uses in that statement could also be applied to Trump, right?
Right.
Dour, sullen, unsmiling. I mean, it's not like Donald Trump is Mr. Sunshine, you know? And yeah, if I were Mitch McConnell, if I were Mitch McConnell with a Twitter account, I think my reply would be something to the effect of, you know, I've won re-election five or six times, whatever it is, and you didn't, you know, I'm the political survivor here. You're the one who's carping from the outside. So,
but, something, you know, along the lines of, I don't like people who lose elections. You know, thinking about Trump's comment about,
yeah, that'd be
right,
a
yeah,
one.
Yeah.
John McCain. You'd be very good at this. You should go work for him.
Rosemary, I think you're back.
Yeah, I don't have a dog in this fight. I don't like either of them. I think their insults to each other are both correct. And so, where does that leave us?
Well, that's an insult. To dogs.
To dogs.
To dogs.
Yeah.
Sorry, Mary.
But it does bode for a continued potential splintering of the Republican Party. And this is something that's going to be really, really interesting to watch, to see what happens.
Well, what do you think is going to happen?
I think you may see the development of a third party.
Which would be great news for the Democrats, that's for sure, right? Third party would be great. But the Republican rank and file, Bob, tell me if I'm wrong about this, is still sticking with Trump in historic numbers.
Yeah, but it is. But, you know, it's funny. Before the show, I looked up these numbers because I was interested in it. Of all the registered voters in the country, only 29% are Republicans, 33% are Democrats, and 34% are independents.
Right.
So when we start talking about this sort of monolithic Republican bloc, understand that it's a smaller and smaller percentage of the overall demographics. So that's true.
Of course, yeah. Of course, what we have to worry about, or what people have to worry about, is who turns out.
Yeah.
That's why the Democrats traditionally lost, even though the Republicans were always smaller in numbers.
And Alan, if I had to bet, I would have bet on Biden's win, but I never would have bet that Trump would have got 73 million votes. So, I mean, I really did miss the level of support that he did have.
The way this country's divided, there's no question, and it has been since the Civil War. Same people, only different ancestors.
Do you really think, writes Martha, that Trump knows and can use the word dour? Maybe even sullen. Someone else had a hand in this. Stephen Miller, question mark? We go to Kathleen, who says Mitch's statement about Trump.
Talk about sullen and dour. I think Stephen Miller's picture is a dictionary.
Yeah, there you go. Works. That's also a good point. Mitch's statement about Trump's culpability is about appeasing corporate donors, not about morality, because he has none. We go to this letter from Susan. Does anyone really believe Trump wrote that statement all by himself? So similar to the other one. Let's see. Ricky says, good for Congressperson Kissinger. His family didn't sound too supportive anyway. So there you go. On the Mike Pence issue, a great point on Mike Pence. Here's another. What is Mike Pompeo up to these days? There's a lot of also on a milk carton, right?
No, actually, I've seen him do a couple of interviews. He was making some comments about China the other day. So he still is, I think, elevating his standing in Kansas. And I do expect to see him back in politics.
You see him as a potential presidential candidate?
I do. I in his mind, not in my mind. I mean, I wouldn't vote for him, period. But I think in his mind, he sees himself as a definitely a viable candidate.
Let's go to another. We just have about 9 minutes or so before the next break. And I would like to talk about the minimum wage fight that is going on. President Biden indicates he's open to negotiation on $15 minimum wage. Comments come as attention turns to passing the $1.9 trillion relief bill on Capitol Hill. The president participated in a CNN town hall in Milwaukee on Tuesday and said he was open to negotiation for the $15 minimum wage, a centerpiece of his $1.9 trillion coronavirus relief bill that's emerged. We've talked a lot about the relief bill in sort of totality, and we've touched on the $15, but I would like to go a little bit into that. Biden said no one should work 40 hours a week and live in poverty, but it's totally legitimate for small business owners to be concerned about how that changes. The federal minimum wage is now $7.25 an hour. Raising it to $15 has been a longtime goal of liberal lawmakers on Capitol Hill, who are determined to keep it in Biden's coronavirus relief legislation, despite opposition from some key moderate Democrats in the Senate. Biden has previously suggested that the minimum wage increase might not make it into the final version of the relief bill. Biden said last night, let's say you said you're going to increase the minimum wage from $7.25 an hour between now and the year 2025 to $12 an hour to $13 an hour. You'd double someone's pay, and the impact on business would be absolutely de minimis, and it would grow the GDP. Alan.
Well, this whole business about involves hidden messages from Biden, I think. When Biden says, I'm all for it, but I may have to take it out of the may have to take it out of the mix, he's basically endorsing, I think, the idea that it will not fly. In other words, he's not fighting like crazy for it.
Rosemary.
I thought it was the opposite, that he's going to push through what he wants and what he can get. He doesn't really have a whole lot of wiggle room if there are moderate Democrats who are going to go against it. He has to have them lined up. But I thought this was a signal that, well, there's still some things we can talk about. I didn't think he was going to take it out. I think he knows, that's why it's there to begin with, that now is the time to move on going big. And really, we act like this is so big, but we're talking there's a 5-year lead-in period. This is not like a major switch in economics. I think a whole lot of the concern about the disruption that increasing the minimum wage will cause is made up. And I think Biden knows that, too. He's been studying this for a long time. So I think it's a sop saying, you know, I'm not absolutely, he couldn't get out and say at a town hall that I've decided this is going to pass and nothing you can say is going to change my mind. That would be a Trump move. He's saying, yeah, yeah, we can still talk. So I don't know. I guess I can see it either way.
Bob?
Yeah, you know, I've got sort of mixed feelings on this. I appreciate the concern from particularly the small business owners. I will note that some of the opposition that I'm reading from some Democrats, but a lot of Republicans, is completely reverse of what they were saying about the tax break that to the wealthy that they gave back. And
you notice that.
Yeah, that was fine, but
yeah,
somehow raising the minimum wage to I don't even know if $15 is a living wage, so I'm not even going to use that term. I do think, you know, that the 2025 is interesting, considering if you think about the tax breaks, so that they put those in immediately. I mean, if the federal government decides that they want to do this, there are ways that they could protect the small business owners. I think in the long term, it is much better for our communities that there is a viable minimum wage. I really do. And I think that money goes right back into the economy. And I frankly hope that they continue to support a $15 minimum wage. If they don't, I would be, you know, okay, I think 13 is better than none and 12 is better than none. But I think 15 is a good starting point.
Chris?
Well, I mean, I think Biden realizes he doesn't have the votes for it at the moment. He's going to lose a few moderate Democrats. And so the question is, you know, I think he's always been willing to kind of horse trade and to negotiate. And I think that's kind of what we're seeing. He's suggesting that he might be open to either taking it out or lowering it from 15 a little bit, which, given the circumstances, is justifiable. I guess as some people on the left would argue that they would like to see him fighting for it a lot harder. But I think he's, you know, Biden has always been pretty aware of political realities. I've never really liked it when big major issues are kind of crammed into these huge packages. I don't really see that it would be a problem to kind of debate the minimum wage separately and divorce it from the stimulus package. But
well,
you know,
except
there are arguments
except
for and against that as well.
Well, except that obviously the people are wildly enthusiastic about. We see that in the polling about the package. And if you take it out, you know, you would have more trouble, right? I think you recognize that.
Potentially. I mean, potentially, but it also could be that this ends up being a sticking point that holds up the package for a little while. I mean, there are different ways to play it. You know, the minimum wage is, I certainly think the minimum wage needs to go up, but I do think you have to be cautious about it. You know, if you raise the minimum wage too quickly at a time when there are already employment problems in this country, you could exacerbate them. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there are reasons to be cautious.
Right.
I think, you know, you have to be careful. Everyone talks about the business owners, but I'd be more worried about people at the lower rung of the ladder who could lose their jobs if business owners feel forced to cut.
Rosemary?
I've been trying to do some reading before we came on today about the arguments pro and con raising the minimum wage, and the loss of jobs is a real threat. And it does hit the people at the lowest level. So that is something I would really be worried about. On the other hand, it's been the cudgel used to keep prices low, and you should not have to work two jobs in order to make ends meet in this country. And that's just the bottom line. And I think that there would be an adjustment. We're not talking, as Chris mentioned, about doing this overnight. There's a 5-year lead-in line. And Biden specifically mentioned we could stretch out the time if that would make it easier. But we don't have many states even. There's a handful looking at doing it or have just done it that have $15 an hour wage. And what have been the results there? It seems to me we should be studying the empirical evidence. I don't know it. I guess we should ask our economist about this when he comes back on. But I would like to see us do it. I don't see it as a downer. I've said over and over again that all this money that's being pumped into the economy by these proposed COVID relief measures would come right back into the economy. People are not hoarding. These are not business owners who got a tax cut and then immediately bought up their own stock and increased their capital holdings. It would go right back into the economy, and that's actually what we need right now.
All right.
And if I could note, if real quick, you know, if we could figure a way to...
I don't think we have time for you to even be real quick. I apologize.
No,
we have to take a break, and we will do that when we come back. I would love to hear what you have to say, Bob. We'll take a break. We'll come back. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll return after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our last hurrah here for this morning. Alan Chartek, Chris Churchill, Bob Griffin, and Rosemary Armeo make up our panel. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. Bob, we go to you.
Yeah, this real quickly, you know, I don't understand. We can figure out how to give farmers subsidies, even after the whole issue of the China situation not buying agriculture. We could figure out how to give small business owners a cushion to allow for a $15 minimum wage. I'm not talking that whole failed PPP program, which I think is an absolute mess. But there are models that we could look at, particularly some of the models that were coming out of some of the EU countries, where the subsidies were going to the businesses to continue to pay to support payroll from COVID. So I think there's some models there that we should be thinking about, but. I keep going back to, you know, when there is a will, we can move huge amounts of money and resources to help some. And my question is, why are we not helping others?
Anybody else?
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting. That I'm just kind of running through Bob's proposal in my head. And I think the immediate objection that would come, that I think would be raised to that, is that any sort of benefit to employers for an increased minimum wage is going to enrich the Amazons of the world and the Walmarts, companies that can already pay the $15 minimum wage if they wanted to, right? I mean, I think that's one of the reasons that the minimum wage issue is so complicated, is that we all know that there are major corporations that could pay it tomorrow and still be immensely profitable, but we also know there are small businesses that can't pay it without getting rid of an employee or two. So it's just kind of, how do you balance all those competing interests?
But you can create the law. I mean, they could build the law that you know, runs us through the Small Business Administration, you know, puts limits on it. I mean, they could do this. And you're right. You're hitting on, I think, sort of one of the points that we really aren't talking about, is that there are companies out there who are making obscene profits right now that could and should be paying this.
Susan writes,
well, Amazon.
Go ahead.
And
go ahead, right. Rosemary.
I was going to say Amazon recently announced it was going to $15. So that's true. I think that putting pressure, political pressure on big companies to do this is way important. But I think the real concern about increasing the minimum wage right now is the pressure that COVID has already put on small businesses. Like, how many restaurants and small shops, and just look at one block in New York City to see how this how small business is already under like massive pressure. Adding tax now would be a huge problem. But you're right that there's a way to structure this to make it work so that the pressure isn't now. It comes a little bit later when maybe they're back in business. And in the meantime, what are you going to do with all those people who are out of jobs, who are making zero salary, not even a minimum wage? What happens to them? That falls back on the federal government to support, too, through unemployment. So there's no way that you save money on this deal. It's a matter of structuring it so that the economy comes back up in stages.
Chris?
Yeah, I mean, another part of the problem is we don't know that a lot of the jobs that disappeared over the last year are in this kind of sector, retail sectors. We don't know yet that those jobs are even coming back. And we don't want to do anything to discourage those jobs from coming back. So it is complicated.
Susan writes to us and says,
by the way, I'd be a little skeptical of that Amazon announcement. I mean, it was great that they're going to pay everybody $15 an hour, but, you know, they may also end up automizing a lot of the jobs that currently aren't. earning $15 an hour. Companies have a way of kind of creating good publicity for themselves while also doing things in the back
like
end
the utilities
that mitigate the circumstances.
Let's go back to that old chestnut. Susan writes to us and says,
true. I do think he's right to be skeptical of it. However, they made a public announcement, so it's going to look really bad on them to back down or to instead just eliminate all the jobs, pay top salary to, you know, half the number of workers they had now. That certainly looks bad, and I hope their public relations people consider that. But it's always good to look skeptically at what companies announce and say they're going to do.
Well, what if what they're doing is a good thing, as opposed to all the skepticism that you and others may have about it, Rosemary? I mean, what if they just decide that, you know, this is right. Yeah. We have more money than anybody else in the world, and we should do this.
And we should pay it. Yeah, I do. I think Amazon has a moral responsibility, but then I'm the one who thinks companies should act more humanely, and they won't unless government forces them, and that means federal regulation. So there you go. We get into that whole thing. It's a whole difference in philosophy. The bigger issue, and this is a Jim Hendler thing, is that you can't stop automation or artificial intelligence or robots or all the things that are going to take over. Jobs need to change in this country, and you can't legislate paying high wages for a job that a machine can do. You need to be planning educational systems and job structures, employment structures that take advantage of automation, but put people in jobs that you really need people in. It's the same thing as switching miners, people out of coal mining into something else. It's in the short run, it's incredibly disruptive. There's no easy way to do it. I'm very glad not to be a coal miner. And yet, what does it mean for overall?
Let us, I've been trying to read Susan's letter, so we'll go to that one. If the only way that a small business owner can make a living is by paying their employees a wage so small that they are not able to make a living, that business owner should not be in business. What do you think of that philosophy?
I think given where we are with COVID and the fact that the every market has been disrupted, I'm not sure I can support that letter. I think there's a lot of other pressures right now that that small business owners are under.
Anybody else?
Yeah, I think that's a little harsh too. Yeah. I mean, a lot of those small business owners aren't making much more than minimum wage themselves. So it's, you know, I think most of them are trying to do the best they can for their employees. And I would, you know, I think most of us would rather work for your average small business owner, your average small retail store than one of the giants. They just, which tend to treat their employees pretty poorly.
Okay, let's move on. We only have a few minutes. I just want to get to this story because I just enjoyed reading it, and I want to, hopefully you will be amused by it as well. Last Wednesday afternoon, when former President Donald Trump's legal team gathered in a conference room in a special suite at the Trump Hotel in Washington, a longtime advisor to Mr. Trump, Justin Clark, had an announcement to make. Mr. Clark said one of the lawyers, Bruce Castor, that after his widely panned performance a day earlier, Mr. Trump did not want him appearing on television anymore during the impeachment trial. Mr. Castor rose from his chair and began angrily shouting at Mr. Clark, arguing that Mr. Trump was wrong to demote him. The back and forth became so heated that Mr. Castor left the conference room in a huff. He later apologized to Mr. Clark, but the tense exchange was just one example of how Mr. Trump's hastily assembled legal team, a mashup of political hands, personal injury lawyers, a former prosecutor, and a longtime defense lawyer, most of whom did not particularly like or trust one another, clashed, stumbled, and regrouped throughout the impeachment proceeding under the watchful and sometimes wrathful eye of its client. The result was an airplane held together with duct tape as it tried to land, writes Maggie Haberman. I think it's important at this point to point out that, you know, they did win.
And they knew they were going to win right from the very beginning.
Right, yeah. But that's still.
But they still didn't do what he wanted them to, which is to argue that he was the rightful president of the United States.
And it was also a part of this article is that there were so many clashes between the lawyers that they hired more lawyers because the lawyers needed lawyers, which I like too. Yeah. Bob?
So Joe, what you're saying, Joe, is that they fight. I'm sorry, I'm having PTSD from the last week's
yeah, the
the debacle of defense.
Yes. Any thoughts on this, Bob?
There are a couple. One is that I think it shows how sort of bankrupt Trump's position is and has been, that you know, any viable law firm was running away from him. I mean, it was, I thought it was an abysmal performance. And if the fix hadn't been in, and frankly, I call it a fix because I felt that there was justice was not done, and that this went in as a foregone conclusion. It was Kabuki theater. But you know, I keep looking at Trump's legal teams and I just raise my eyebrows, and I go all the way back to before the election, and then after the election, that whole, you know, Four Seasons stuff. I mean, it's like one debacle after another. I mean, there's a sitcom here. I mean, there's a legal sitcom that if we wrote, people would be, wow, you couldn't, you know, this
that couldn't
real.
Happen. But, yeah.
You're right. And it is.
Chris?
With all his money,
I like that. I like that
attorneys.
Sitcom idea. Can we work on that? Flush that out and
womp womp womp.
Take it to Netflix. I think we're on to something.
It would be a cast of characters. I mean, his attorneys look like the bar scene from Star Wars.
I'm sorry. What? They look like what?
It looks like the bar scene from Star Wars. honest to God, I look
Cantina
at it going.
Cantina scene, yes.
Yeah, who thought this was a good idea?
Rosemary?
Well, we can make jokes about it, and I certainly am laughing along with everybody else. But why isn't the Bar Association investigating these guys, starting with Rudolph Giuliani? It's supposed to be wrong for lawyers to make false claims in defending their clients, and every one of Trump's is guilty of this, and yet nothing has happened. There has been no nothing has been done to stop them or to curtail them or to chastise them. And I don't know. I can't imagine that this past 4 years has increased admissions to law school, because it's so deplorable.
Where are you going to go if you don't go to law school? You have to go to journalism school. And you've talked enough about that, Rosemary, that, you know, there aren't the jobs there. So you see what I mean here?
STEM. You have to go into STEM research. Go to RPI.
There you go.
Go to medical
school. Go work for a hedge fund.
Yeah, yeah, they're buying all the newspapers. That's better than journalism school.
Yeah.
All right, we have just 2 minutes left. Stay or go, Biden, long a critic of Afghan deployments, faces a deadline. I believe that deadline is May 1st. Is that correct? I believe it is. Mm-hmm. I think that is what I read. The previous two presidents of the United States declared they wanted to pull all American troops out of Afghanistan, and they both decided in the end that they could not do it. Now President Biden is facing the same issue with a deadline less than 3 months away. Bob, we've talked a lot about this. We only have about a minute left, but what do you think?
I think it's a conundrum that we're going to face, that, you know, we pull out right now, we leave pretty much guaranteeing a return of the Taliban rule in Afghanistan. And a sudden pull down of even the minimal number of troops we have will create a level of instability that I don't think is acceptable. This is why it's so dangerous to get involved in these situations, but it's also really hard to get out of.
Alan?
Well, it is a tough situation now, and we know it. And, you know, the only thing I can say is Biden has to carry on and push forward, because he knows what he's doing, and he's always proven that to us.
All right, folks, we are out of time. I want to thank you all for being with us. It's great to have you here. My thanks, of course, to Alan. Alan, thank you very much.
Thank you, Joe.
Also, thanks to Chris and Bob and Rosemary. Thank you. Also, thanks to writing letters to us. We love getting your letters for the most part. And we will, what do we go to next? We go to Congressional Corner. We do have that, and we'll be right back after this.